Okay, welcome to the next installment of our Great Rivalries series. We've been learning Jewish history and learning about great personalities and their Torah in the context of examining their rivalries. Just want to remind everyone, tomorrow night is the second installment of a new series we began called Best Version of Yourself, Becoming the Best Version of You, drawing from books like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Good to Great, Essentialism combined with the timeless Torah teachings of our rabbis. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m. So great rivalries. Tonight we have the privilege of studying about the rivalry between Rav Shach and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. On the one hand, it's a little bit sad that we have all these rivalries. Couldn't we all get along? We spoke in the Parsha class this morning. Vayechi, the book of Bereishis, ends with the hope of unity, a hope of brotherhood. Why do we need these rivalries? We're not going to talk about it tonight. Perhaps it's a topic for another time, but were the rivalries necessary kind of agitators and catalysts for Jewish history? Or could we have lived without them? What would Jewish history have looked like without these rivalries? Not our topic, but a good question. So tonight, Rav Shach and Lubavitcher Rebbe, by a show of hands, how many people here met Rav Shach? Whoa, okay. And by a show of hands, how many met the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Okay, also a nice amount. What's exciting about this is if I asked you how many met Rav Yaakov Emden, Rav Yonis, and Eibshitz, I hope nobody would put their hand up. You never know. But I hope no one. So it's exciting. We're learning about personalities who not only come to life, but they were alive in our lifetime to the extent that people in this room have met these personalities. What we're going to do, similar to what we did when we examined the rivalry of the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem, is first we're going to study the background of Rav Shach. Then we'll examine much more briefly, because I think people are more familiar, the background of the Rebbe. And then we'll see their conflict, their rivalry, what it was all about. Rav Shach, Rav Elazar Menachem Man Shach, was born 1899, passed away in 2001. You can't see well, but it's in the handout. He was born in Vabolnik, Lithuania. Lita. He was a Litvish Yid. At the age of 11, he went to learn in Panovich under the Rosh Yeshiva of Itzel Panovicher. So he had a very early association with Panovich from his youth. Most of us think of Rav Shach, we think of him as the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich in Bnei Brak. But at 11 years old, he was learning in a very different Panovich, not the one in Bnei Brak, but rather the original Panovich. Panovich is not the name of a town in Israel. It's the name of a town in Lita in Lithuania. At age 15, he transferred to go learn in Slobodka, the famed Slobodka yeshiva that produced so many luminaries of the last generation. Really, the transformational leaders of the 20th century, many had in common that they studied in Slobodka under the altar of Slobodka. From Rav Huttner to Rav Ruderman to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky to Rabbi Teitz, and the list goes on and on. Well, Rav Shach, at 15, went to Slobodka under Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. A year later, 1914, World War I broke out. And Rav Shach began traveling on Europe town to town. He's a young man, a teenager at the time. World War I was not a pleasant time for Jews. They were not people's top priority. And he was on the run, literally, as many were, for his life. He went town to town, constantly trying to stay ahead of the latest persecution or oppression, and he would sleep and eat wherever possible. But wherever town he was in and wherever he found his meal and a place to rest his head, he always first went to find the Beis Medrash. Rav Shach, from a young age, was fully immersed in Torah learning. That was his life source. It was his essence. It was everything that he was about. For 2 years, Rav Shach hid in an attic. All he had with him was a sefer of Akiva Eger. Any Yavamos? It's an interesting question. If you ever have a dinner party, you have a Shabbos meal, it's an excellent question to ask people. If you were going to be stuck in an attic, if you were going to be on a deserted island, what one book would you want to have with you? In other words, what book could you tolerate reading over and over? I'm going to guess, there are many righteous people in this room, I'm not sure Yavamos would hit the top of the list for many in this room. And if you had a second book you could bring, I'm not sure it would be Chedusha Rabbi Kiva Eger. But Rav Shach was bliss, was heaven, Gan Eden. To be in an attic 2 years, not that he wanted to be hiding in the attic, But if he had to be in the attic to be accompanied with a Gemara Yevamos and Rabbi Kiva Eger, there was a woman who fed him every day. She brought food and water. The woman, like Rav Shach didn't survive the war. He came before the war, but both were alive after the Holocaust. And when the woman was buried in Israel, Rav Shach was so indebted his whole life to this woman who sustained him during those years that it was pouring during her funeral. He walked along the coffin the entire way to the cemetery. He bestowed great honor upon her in gratitude for her generosity. This is, by the way, Rav Shach's passport picture from the 1920s. I'm not sure that makes the rounds in Bnei Brak, but it's safe to share it here. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'akol nehiyeh bevarach. In his introduction to his Avi Ezri, which is his seminal work on the Rambam, it's his magnum opus, so the Rav Shach writes in his introduction the following: how can I thank Hashem for all the kindness He bestowed upon me during my youth, when I had nothing? It is impossible to describe the conditions in which we live during this period, when the authorities deported all the Jews from Lithuanian cities, and I did not know where my parents were. I was alone. I did not have any way of contacting them. I lived this way for several years, and I suffered terribly. A very human side of Rav Shach. We're going to see a lot of rhetoric from Rav Shach shortly, but in his youth, we have access to this human side. No access to his parents, running town to town in World War I, hiding in an attic, surviving only due to the generosity of this woman who fed him. And all these years later, in the comfort of Bnei Brak, assuming you find that comfortable, in the comfort of Bnei Brak, when he pens his magnum opus, the Avi Ezri, he still remembers that loneliness, he remembers that experience and that suffering. That's what he writes about. Early years, in 1915, he travels to Slutsk to study under Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. 1921, there are regional political issues. The yeshiva split. Rav Issa Zalman stayed in Slutsk, and his son-in-law, Rav Aaron Cutler, a name familiar to many. How many here met Rav Aaron Cutler? Baruch Hashem. Rav Issa Zalman and his son-in-law, Rav Aaron Cutler, didn't split because they couldn't get along. They split because, you know, boundaries were redrawn every other day. Yesterday you lived in this country, tomorrow it's that country, yesterday was this city, tomorrow was that city. There was regional political discord, and they had to split. So two yeshivas, Rav Issa Zalman remained in Slutsk, and Rav Aaron Cutler in Kletsk. Rav Shach went to Kletsk with Rav Aaron, maintained a relationship with Rav Aaron Cutler throughout his life, and he was appointed a Rebbe, although he was a very young age. He was such a prodigy, so brilliant, and so diligent in his studies, that he was appointed a Rebbe at a young age. 1923, Rav Shach marries Rav Issa Zalman's niece, Gittel Gilmovsky, and they moved to the Mir, not the Mir in Yerushalayim. They moved to the Mir in Poland. Shortly after, they moved back to Kletsk. By the way, they moved to the Mir because that's where Gittel was from. The minhag was, when you first get married, you move to where the wife is from, often because there's a dowry, there's the support of the father-in-law to continue to learn. I'm not sure the details if the dowry dried up or for whatever reason, but shortly after, Rav Shach and Gittel moved back to Kletsk. Rav Issa Zalman at that time moved to Israel, Palestine at the time, and Rav Shach became involved in the leadership of the yeshiva in place of his wife's uncle. After Meir Shapiro, the great Lubliner Rav, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chochmei Lublin, we're familiar with Meir Shapiro, known as the founder of Daf Yomi, an incredible feat. I don't think he had rivals, so it would have to be in a different context. But Meir Shapiro is a fascinating personality to study in his own right. He was a visionary. How many thousands of people around the world, thousands of people, are literally on the same page because of him? And we think, wow, I'm sure he introduced the idea, and everyone thought, it's a brilliant idea. Where do we sign up? It's perfect. It's brilliant. Nobody bought into it. Rav Meir Shapiro met a wall of opposition. And he had to fight through and fight through and fight through. And it was introduced at the Knesset Gdola. And finally, people subscribed to it. And today, after numerous cycles of the Daf, how many are Shas Yidden? How many have finished Shas because of Rav Meir Shapiro's perseverance and because of his vision? Daf Yomi, and I know he's not our topic for tonight, Daf Yomi is an incredible unifier. There are men learning the daf, there are women learning the daf. There are Orthodox Jews learning the daf, and there are not. It's unbelievable. There was a person in our community who was not a Shomer Shabbos, and I remember a number of years ago, he said, I'm flying to New York, I'm going to the Siyum HaShas. I said, oh wow, that's like, you know, people go to the Chabad Kinnas HaShluchim, you know, whose guest are you that you were invited to the Siyum HaShas? He said, no, I'm making a Siyum HaShas. What do you mean you're making a Siyum HaShas? That was like the last thing. He said, yeah, I heard that there's a program to do a page a day, and the Talmud is the basis of the whole Jewish tradition, rabbinic law. I was curious, and I made the commitment, a page a day. I finished Shas. So you have observant, non-observant, it's incredible, all Rav Meir Shapiro. So when Rav Meir Shapiro passed away, how many had been to the Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin? Okay? Me too. It's very powerful to learn the daf in the Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin. I'll tell you a little secret I'm not supposed to be announcing yet, but BRS is having a trip to Poland this summer with hopefully my wife and I leading it. So this summer we're having a week-long trip to Poland for those who will want to join us. You go to Lublin, you go to Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin, you're not in charge of the kids, don't worry. You go to Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin and you open the daf, it's unbelievable. It was turned into a medical school, but it's been reclaimed since then. Anyway, Rav Meir Shapiro passed away, and Rav Shach was recruited to lead the Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin. You have to understand, do you have any idea how many dapim you had to know Baal Peh to be considered for entrance to Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin? It wasn't like anyone could go. Lakewood and Meir today, the largest yeshivas in the world, which are very prominent yeshivas at a very high level, and God forbid I would never suggest anything disparaging, but acceptance is not super challenging. In other words, you don't have to prove your brilliance. They have thousands and thousands of talmidim. Yeshivas Chochmei Lublin, Volozhin, Slobodka were tiny in comparison. Tiny, tiny, tiny. But Chochmei Lublin was the elite of the elite to get in. And yet, it tells you of Rav Shach's genius that he was the one recruited and asked to replace Rav Chaim Ozer, the undisputed Gadol Ador of Europe at the time. Rav Chaim Ozer in Vilna was suggested that Rav Shach take over. I'm sorry, he was suggested Rav Chaim Ozer said Rav Shach should turn down the position, which he did. Short time later, he was Rosh Yeshiva of the Vardik, and then he became the Rosh Yeshiva of the Karlin Yeshiva. Why is it significant that Rav Shach served as the Rosh Yeshiva of the Karlin Yeshiva in Europe? Because what we'll study tonight is his great rivalry with Chabad. And one could erroneously conclude that this is consistent with the age-old rivalry that I last taught in this course, the Gra and the Baal Shem. Of course, Rav Shach's a Litvisha, Sunlita, Lithuania, and the Rebbe is continuing the line, the Baal Tanya, Talmud, going back to the Baal Shem, but that's not what it was about. Evidenced partly by the fact that yet in Europe, Rav Shach was a Rosh Yeshiva of the Karliner Yeshiva. Shortly before the Holocaust, Rav Shach's uncle helped Rav Aaron Cutler escape to the United States. Rav Aaron got a visa, was able to come to the U.S. even before the war. We're all familiar that he set up shop in Lakewood, New Jersey. He tried to find a rural, off-the-map, out-of-town, inaccessible place to rebuild Torah. But despite his being all the way in southern New Jersey, Rav Aaron, though he survived by coming early, he was dedicated. The Varatzalus, Rav Aaron, with Irvin Bunim, all of his efforts on behalf of European Jewry. So Rav Aaron got out. 1939, Rav Shach and his family go to Vilna. They stay with Rav Chaim Ozer. 1939, notice the year. Rav Shach was on the move because he had to be. And in Vilna, he found refuge. But it was there that his mother and his eldest daughter, who was 14 at the time, passed away. Early 1940, after he consults the Brisker Rav, who is the Brisker Rav? Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, the brother of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe, the father of the Rav. The Rav's uncle, the Brisker Rav. Rav Chaim's son, the Brisker Rav. So Rav Shach consults the Brisker Rav and Rav Chaim Ozer, and he moves to Palestine to be with his wife's uncle, Rav Isser Zalman. So 1940 still gets out in time. At the time, it was called not Israel, it's 1940. What was it called? What was Rav Shach? A Palestinian. He moved to Palestine and he became a Palestinian. Jews were living there. He joined his Palestinian uncle, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, and Palestine. Rav Shach joins the yeshiva Eitz Chaim. This is the yeshiva in the picture. As Rosh Yeshiva, his wife's uncle, Rav Issa Zalman, had founded a yeshiva in Yerushalayim, Eitz Chaim. When Rav Shach first gets to Israel, to Palestine, he joins his uncle as a Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva. However, shortly later, the Ponovitch Rav, Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, refounds the Ponovitch Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. Incredible stories how Bnei Brak was desolate, was not a built-up town at the time. I wish Rav Yehuda, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, were here. He could give this class a million times over. He was there, he lived it, he knew these people. If only I could have spoken to him to prepare for this class. Ponovitch was Bnei Brak is a desolate, desolate town. But the Ponovitch Rav had amazing vision. Others saw a barren hilltop. He saw a thriving Torah community. And he reestablished the Ponovitch Yeshiva, and he asked Rav Shach to join him. If you've been in the Ponovitch Yeshiva, you recognize their famous gold Aron Kodesh on the left. That Aron only came much later, after its founding, and it is 16th century Italian, and it was relayered with gold leaf in Israel. It's a remarkable Aron Kodesh. It's worth going to Ponovitch to see the Aron. Rav Shach serves as Rosh Yeshiva, gives a weekly shiur until his passing, and at the same time, he was involved in Chinuch Atzmai, the Vada Yeshivas. He was involved politically, we'll see. So unlike some of the Talmidei Chachamim that we've studied, who were exclusively immersed in their learning and their scholarship, Rav Shach, almost from his arrival in Palestine, certainly after the State of Israel is founded, is involved in representing the interests of what he considers the Torah true community, what we would call the Haredi Litvisha community, and he does so by being involved in politics, in Vada Yeshivas, and so on. To Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda. Our member of our blessed memory. 1917, till his passing, Rav Shach is considered in Israel the Gadol Hador of the Litvisha community. Whatever Haredi world you belong to throughout the width and breadth of Israel, Rav Shach was the authoritative Gadol Hador. He was instrumental in Israel in creating a presumption of yeshiva study and kol learning and Torah, community learning Torah, primary to him above everything else. The parallel in America to Rav Shach in Israel was Rav Kotler. Rav Aaron came to America and promoted something that had never existed heretofore. Some people have a revisionist memory of Jewish history and like to believe that the default always was you got married, you sat and learned in Kollel, and that was the life. You were provided for by others. Never happened. Yechidei Skula. Rare exceptions were supported in their learning. Perhaps people got married and learned for a year or two, but the notion of an indefinite Kollel lifestyle was an invention of post-Holocaust, post-World War II. And why was it invented? I say this with no judgment. And in fact, if there is a judgment, it's a favorable judgment with gratitude. So much Torah and so many Torah luminaries were wiped out that there needed to be a surge of Torah learning, a tsunami of Torah learning to reestablish our transmission, our tradition, our Mesorah. Did the original people who instituted it intend on it lasting forever? That's an age-old question. For Aaron Kotler had a Tchias HaMesim and came to Lakewood today. Would he have nachas? Would he have concerns? It's an age-old question. Did they intend it indefinitely? But Rav Aaron Kotler brought that hashkafa to America, and Rav Shach brought that hashkafa and advocated for it in Israel, and was at the forefront of the debates about yeshiva students serving in the army, and so on and so forth. He saw Torah as so primary to him. We're going to learn about his son in a moment, which may surprise you. But his son was asked, because you'll see that his son did not go in his father's path, did they have a good relationship? And he said there was a year and a half that we didn't talk. And one would think, well, maybe they didn't talk for the reasons we're about to see. But his son clarified to the interviewer, no, let me tell you the circumstances why we didn't talk. He said, my mother died. Rebbetzin Shach passed away. And when Rav Shach called his son, he was in America at the time, and he said, don't come, we're not waiting for you, we're doing the funeral right away. And his son said, what do you mean? This is my mother. I'll hop on the next plane, can't you wait? And Rav Shach's explanation of why he couldn't wait was, There are thousands of yeshiva boys saying Tehillim because she passed away. There is a crisis of Bittul Torah. We need to bury her as soon as possible so they get back to learning. His son was so bothered, so offended, that they didn't talk for a year and a half. But a year and a half later, Rav Shachat had a surgery. He was in the hospital. His son came as he was convalescing. He helped him, cared for him. And he saw the indescribable pain that it caused Rav Shach when he was in the hospital, when he was recuperating, that he wasn't able to learn as much as he wanted. And he understood that it wasn't his father's insensitivity to him. His father just saw Torah learning as air we breathe. If it's a choice between you're making it to your mother's funeral or thousands of young men suffocating because they have no air, that's how Rav Shach saw it. He came to appreciate that and he reconciled with his father. Rav Shach was adamantly opposed to secular and religious Zionism. But here's the interesting thing. Unlike some who were opposed to secular and religious Zionism and advocated boycotting the State of Israel, not recognizing the State of Israel, sitting out the State of Israel, protesting the State of Israel, Rav Shach said, not a Zionist, but if there is Jewish sovereignty in the land, if there is an Israeli government, everyone must vote. And why did he advocate everyone voting? Because he had such a belief in civic duty? No, because he thought that the system needs to be used to advance his Torah ideals. Rav Shach felt a vote not cast for the right party is effectively cast for the wrong party and will get the wrong results. So he participated in the Israeli election system. He backed and he led different parties during his lifetime. Not all of the other Gedolei Yisrael agreed with him. So he joined parties, he broke away from parties, he was a member of parties, he left parties, but he always engaged the system because he was working the system to advance his interests. Rav Shach waged numerous public battles against anything he deemed inconsistent with Torah ideals and Torah values. While many others had their nose only in the books, Rav Shach had his nose in the books. He was an outstanding, extraordinary Talmud Chacham. But simultaneously, he saw himself as the vanguard, as the warrior protecting Torah ideals. He once said, quote, "There's no need to worry about machlokas, because if it's done for the sake of heaven, in the end it will endure," referencing the Mishnah Navos. One is obligated to be a Baal machlokas. It is no feat to be in agreement with everybody. It is no feat to be in agreement with everybody. Now some would end that sentence by saying, but you should try anyway. Rav Shach ended the sentence by saying, you got to stand up for Torah, and if it means you're engaged in machlokas, so be it. And much of Rav Shach's life became defined by numerous machlokas. This is an interesting aside. On Yom HaAtzma'ut, one of the only, if not the only, Haredi yeshiva in Israel that puts an Israeli flag on top of the yeshiva every Yom HaAtzma'ut is the Ponovitch Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. It precedes Rav Shach to the time of Rav Kahaneman, the Ponovitch Rav. Rabbi Wein, who was close with the Ponovitch Rav, who developed that relationship when Rabbi Wein was a Rav here in Miami Beach. And the Ponovitch Rav would come through America to collect money for Yeshivas Ponovitch. He would stay with Rabbi Wein in Miami Beach. They developed a relationship. And the Ponovitch Rav explained it this way. Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Ponovitch Rav, told me that he flew the Israeli flag from the roof of his yeshiva building in Bnei Brak on Yom HaAtzmaut. When some locals complained about this, he answered them with the following. I flew the Lithuanian flag on the roof of my yeshiva in Ponovitch on Lithuanian Independence Day. My friends, it's no worse here. Meaning, you gotta have some national pride. You gotta be patriotic. If I could be patriotic in Lithuania, I could be patriotic in Israel. So the Ponovitch Rav would fly the Israeli flag, and in Ponovitch, from 1948, under the Ponovitch Rav's guidance, they omitted Tachanun in Ponovitch on Yom HaAtzmaut. From what I saw, once the Ponovitch Rav passed away, they began to recite Tachanun, but the Israeli flag remains atop. I was Googling this, I saw that just this past Yom HaAtzmaut, there were some hooligans who tried to rip down the flag. There is always the zealots and the controversy, but the Ponovitch Yeshiva continues to have the Israeli flag fly atop it. Here are some of the examples of the machlokas that Rav Shach was not afraid to engage in. Number one, he attacked Rabbi Soloveitchik. He said about the Rav, quote, he endangers the survival of Torah through Judaism by indoctrinating the masses with actual words of heresy. If you'd like to see where he says that, it's page 1 in the handout. Many of these first pages are from Igros, from the Mechtavim U'Ma'amarim. Mechtavim U'Ma'amarim are a 5 or 6 volume collection of Rav Shach's letters, his correspondence. On the left-hand column on page 1, in kach pnei advarim ben yonim shebein odin l'chaveru mi medaber kvar adeos v'ashkofos. Hey, achem ahalitu esa'am bekfiru v'shimu nam ashekosov godol echad bisifro. The godol echad he's referring to is the Rav. Mamish divere kfiru ad kedei ishtomimus l'mara ayin. So Rav Shach took on the Rav. Number 2, Rabbi Steinsaltz, who should have a refu shleima. He accused Rav Steinsaltz of heresy, put him in cheirim. He said, he's ain tochel geboro, he's not a genuine person. Everyone must keep their distance from him. Page number 2. Sorry, it's a little blurry. The second paragraph. Kfar nisparsim isu mikdole ador sha'asa lulmod, va'af lahach zikem bebayis es ha'shas ha'menukad mi'ish ha'mada Steinsaltz. It is forbidden for you to learn from and even to have in your house the shas with nekudos from the scientist, Renaissance man, Steinsaltz, sheish b'am zilzul b'chazal b'agos of the shas k'mochem b'choshari sifrov yesh b'am kfira u'minus ve'ein lavo ito b'vikuchim ki apikoros. It's not even worth getting in a fight with him because he's an apikoros. Number 3, Rav Shach wrote about Yeshiva University. There was a time that Yeshiva University was going to open up a branch in Israel and bring the unified or one university that housed the opportunity to learn in Yeshiva and attend university. And when Rav Shach got wind of this proposal, he wrote a letter. This letter supposedly went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, asking Rav Moshe to intervene in America. But he writes about YU, that it poses a threat to the survival of authentic Judaism, and that YU in Israel is, quote, an absolute disaster causing the destruction of our Holy Torah. It's page 3. Levato Mezimas Hakamas Yeshiva University Be'eretz Yisrael. It omits the name, the recipient of the letter, but I believe it was Rav Moshe. And he says all the things wrong with YU. Doesn't mention the tuition, but he says all the other things about the YU. And he concludes, Leze anuponim, we're turning to you, Lehizdar, look, them, b'nei rav, v'koach hashpa'asu, yishtadel, with all of your influence, please, stop them, block them, don't let them come here, and the negative impact that they will have. Some of the examples of Rav Shach not shying away from machlokas, what he believed was standing up for Torah true principles. He also, don't think YU was alone, he described Touro College as a terrible disaster, a churban hadas, the destruction of our religion. He said it's forbidden to serve in the Israeli army, a yeshiva student, and if it's necessary, one should die. Yaharag v'al yavor, one should die before serving in the army. He believed for true peace, this is another one of his controversial positions, turn to page 4, Rav Shach was not a lefty by any stretch, but politically, he was a strong advocate for land for peace. He believed that if you knew that returning land would achieve peace, you're obligated to return that land. That's the letter that's here on page 4. Binyan achzar shtachim eretz Yisrael tmura shalom. And he had numerous letters that deal with this issue of giving back, giving away land in order to achieve peace. He criticized Israeli Yeshuvim in Yehuda and Shomron and Gaza, and he writes about them, quote, they are a blatant attempt to provoke the international community. He called on Haredim not to live in those areas. Did they listen to him? If you've been to Beitar Elit or Kiryat, what's it called? Kiryat Sefer. Well, Kiryat Sefer is over the green line? Over the green line, because there was Rav Shach's opinion, and then there was the discounted housing over the green line. So, they didn't listen to him. But you see some of his opinions. Rav Shach, we said, was married to Gittel. She passed away in 1969. He lived a long time as a widower. He had three children, all born in Kletsk in the 1920s. His oldest daughter, Miriam Reisel, died at the age of 14 in Vilna when he was on the run before the Holocaust. His second daughter, Dvora, is married to a prominent Rosh Hashiva today, Rav Meir Tzvi Bergman. And his youngest son, his only son, his youngest child, was named Ephraim. Where is he, a Rosh Hashiva? Right. Ephraim is a very interesting personality. 1929 to 2011. Now remember, Ephraim Shach's father said it's better to die than go to the army. Yeshiva University is a bunch of apikursim, and they're destroying Torah true Judaism and all these other wonderful ideas. Well, his son was learning in the Chevron Yeshiva when he started reading books by Jabotinsky. And he was so moved by Jabotinsky's books that he left the Chevron Yeshiva and he joined the Irgun. And then he served in the Israeli army. When his father first saw him, when he came to his father's home in Bnei Brak in uniform, in this interview he describes that moment. His father looked up from his sefer, confused, and he said, "Was it Purim?" He didn't understand why his son was in an army uniform. And what did he do after serving in the army? Where did he go to earn a doctorate? None other than Yeshiva University. He has a doctorate in history and philosophy from the Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University. He then returned to Israel. He worked at the Israel Ministry of Education throughout his career. Passed away in 2011. That is a picture of Dr. Ephraim Shach. I think it's fascinating. I yet remember hearing, when I was learning in Israel, and I was learning in a Hesder yeshiva, and I yet remember hearing that Rav Shach had one son and he went off the derech. That's in the yeshivas in Israel, they say his son went off the derech. And the story they all tell about why he went off the derech is because Rav Shach at the Shabbos table would be sitting with a sefer. He was always reading the Rambam. And he didn't sing Zmiros. And that later in life, they say in yeshivas, that Rav Shach bemoaned the regret that he didn't sing Zmiros rather than read the Rambam because they say his son went off. Only later did I learn his son was frum, observant, learned, a Talmud Chacham. And in the interview, and there are numerous interviews after Rav Shach passed away, I saw a fascinating, you know, thanks to the internet, you can discover all kinds of amazing things. I read one blog of a person who was learning in Yeshiva HaKotel when Rav Shach passed away, and his Rebbe in Yeshiva HaKotel took him to Dr. Ephraim Shach's home to pay a Shiva call. And they sat and talked about his father. It's first-person testimony about what Dr. Shach said about his father, not to mention the interviews that Dr. Shach did himself. You might imagine they had a very alienated relationship, but they were close. And he always said, which gives us a little bit of a different angle on Rav Shach, that though he took a very different path than his father, for his father, as long as he remained true to Torah and mitzvos and to learning Torah, his father loved him and embraced him, even if he chose a different route for himself. Fascinating. Life doesn't always go the way that we plan. Rav Shach authored two sets of Sfarim. His magnum opus is his Avi Ezri. It's a commentary on the Rambam. Shach was never found without a Rambam, knew the Rambam by heart, and wrote this commentary on the Rambam. And the second is his collection of letters, the Mechtovim Ma'amarim, six volumes of letters. Passed away November 2, 2001. He was almost 103 years old. He's buried in Bnei Brak. Over 200,000 people attended his funeral. Okay, Rav Shach. Yes.
Two things people don't usually mention. Number one, that Shach started his career as a melamed, a teacher in the Mizrahi Zionist religious school in Israel. That's number one. Number two, about Rav Aaron Cutler, is that Bar Haftik went to Vilna and rescued the Miri Shia boys coming through Japan.
Right.
Okay? Whereas Cutler managed to escape, whereas all his Talmud been so these are two little facts.
Yeah.
Mentioned.
When it comes to Rav Shach, I tried to research to the best of my ability. There are rumors, you can find it on a lot of Chabad websites, that Rav Shach tried out to be a Rosh Yeshiva of the Tomchei Tmimim Yeshiva, of the Chabad Yeshiva, and when he wasn't accepted, that's when the rivalry began. And there are rumors that Rav Shach wanted a position at Yeshiva University, was going to migrate to America. There are rumors. I couldn't find any truth to those rumors. What I shared with you is based on... Okay, I didn't see it. In the biographies that I read and referenced, I didn't see it, but I'm not denying that that it may be true. Okay, the Rebbe. Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, born 1902, the 11th of Nisan in Russia, to Rav Levi Yitzchak, a great Kabbalist, his father, Rebbe Tzinchana, his mother, a very righteous woman. He's named after his great-grandfather, Rav Menachem Mendel, the third Rebbe of Chabad. From early childhood, the Rebbe was considered a prodigy. He too was immersed in Torah study. 1929, he marries the sixth Rebbe's daughter, Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka, the younger daughter of the sixth Rebbe, in Warsaw. He then studies. The young married couple moved to Berlin. And the Rebbe studies at the University of Berlin. Who did he meet there? He met Rav Huttner, and he met Rabbi Soloveitchik. We're having a speaker later this year who wrote a book on the Rebbe and the Rav. They had a lifelong friendship that was originally forged. In fact, it's fascinating. In the Rebbe's own letters, he talks about letters back to his father-in-law about the Rav in Berlin, that he heard there was a brilliant Torah scholar, and if he was at the university already, he wanted to also find a scholar with whom he could talk and learning. They used to sit in the coffee houses of Berlin, talking and learning. They found some comfort in one another from worlds that they were no longer immersed in. And that whole relationship of the Rebbe and the Rav is fascinating. Rav Huttner also, you know, it said, and I saw this in one of the biographies of the Rebbe, that the Rebbe used to go to the University of Berlin. He was not enrolled as a full-time student. He was essentially taking electives. And so he would bring a Gemara to the class, because if the topic didn't interest him at the moment, he would stop listening. So the Rav testified that there was a professor who called on the Rebbe. He saw him reading this other book, and he called on him, "Are you listening to what we said?" And the Rebbe repeated back everything the professor had said, and he repeated back everything he had been learning in the Gemara at the time. It said that when Rav Huttner was asked by Chabadniks, "Is it true that our great Rebbe, when he was in the university in class, that he wasn't listening, he had a Gemara he was learning?" You have to understand this is an insight into Rav Huttner. And Rav Huttner could be included in the great rivalries. He had rivals. Rav Huttner, if you understand his sharp wit, Rav Huttner responded and he said, "I don't believe it. It's impossible. Your Rebbe would never learn Gemara without a yarmulke on." June 19th, then the Rebbe later went to the Sorbonne in Paris, where he studied mathematics and physics. June 1941, and there's a lot, it's fascinating, the history of the Rebbe and his wife, both in Berlin and later in Paris. Some of the evidence we have of their lives at the time, nothing, God forbid, negative, but not what you'd consider part of a Hasidish family and lineage, what they were occupied in. At the time, the Rebbe did not seem to be on the path. He wasn't on the trajectory, the professional career path of becoming a Rebbe. June 1941, they escape Europe to the United States. Shortly after his arrival, his father-in-law urges him. He begins to publish, and his genius is soon discovered broadly and widely. He assists his father-in-law even long before he becomes the Rebbe. And he establishes and runs three central Lubavitch organizations: the Merkos Lanyani Chinuch, the Chinuch Network of Lubavitch, the Kahot Publishing Society, which is an enormous undertaking, and the Machane Yisrael Social Service Agency. 1950, his father-in-law, the sixth Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, passes away. And, we're not going to get into it now, it's not the time. It's also a fascinating story. The Rebbe was married to the previous Rebbe's younger daughter. But there was an older daughter who was also married to a rabbi, Rav Gerari, and he wanted the position. He, as the older son-in-law, thought he was the natural heir to become the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. And it's fascinating to see the back and forth. The Rebbe demurred, he hesitated. The one we call the Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, did not assert himself, he did not campaign. In fact, there were months where there were those who were treating him as if he were the Rebbe, and he objected, he refused. He wouldn't accept it. He wouldn't accept it. And it took until a particular Fabrengen, where the Rebbe finally emerged, and he could no longer overcome invitation, and he agreed to become the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. And as the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, he took Lubavitch in a very different direction than his father-in-law. If you ask the average Jew today, observant or non-observant, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, you say the word Chabad, Chabad is practically synonymous with outreach. Outreach. Chabad houses, Lubavitch centers, all over the world. South Dakota, the last of the United States, now has a Chabad house, an outreach center. Today, Chabad is known to us, it's synonymous with outreach. But the previous Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, was not about outreach, but inreach. It was not about collective redemption, it was personal redemption. The original, the Baal HaTanya, Chabad, Chochma Bina Udas, is all about Torah learning, different levels and approaches to Torah learning, but it's about personal redemption, working on oneself personally, not to suggest with a sense of retreat, but certainly not with any campaign to go influence and repair and transform the world. But when the Rebbe took over, he saw his mission in the original address, in the first speech that he gave, his inauguration as the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. We're going to look at some of it momentarily. He spoke about the seventh is the final, like the seventh millennia and Mashiach comes. The seventh is the conclusion, it's the culmination. He viewed his mission was to create a movement that would change and transform the world. He began campaigns, Ufaratzta, to send emissary shluchim across the globe. In the world of Chabad, he created an army. Child is born, and in their mother's milk is a sense of mesiras nefesh, of mission, a charge, a mandate to go out and change the world. To buy a one-way ticket somewhere with no day school and no mikveh and no kosher restaurant. And nevertheless, to be there for God's children because that's your mission. One man, we think that he had continued a mesora for hundreds of years and he just expanded it. No, he really initiated it. Ufaratzta, to change the world. And now on every corner of the globe, and everyone in this room is a beneficiary. Who here hasn't traveled on business or leisure and needed a minyan or a kosher meal or to see a familiar face and found the Chabad house in that community? Changed the world. Every state of the United States of America today. March 2nd, 1992, while praying at the grave of his father-in-law, the Rebbe suffered a major stroke. It paralyzed him on his right side, deprived him of the ability to speak. 2 years, 3 months later, Gimel Tammuz, 1994, the Rebbe passed away. The Rebbe died, as we know. He did not have any biological children. I wrote biological children because he has hundreds of thousands of children whom he influenced, whom he grew. Chazal certainly tell us that when you teach someone Torah, it's as if they are your child. But he didn't have biological children, and we know until today, there is no replacement, there is no eighth Lubavitcher Rebbe. Yes. The Rebbe placed a great emphasis on Mashiach, longing for his arrival. It was a huge part, it informed his worldview, his longing, his personal avoda. His father-in-law had placed an emphasis on personal redemption and perfection. He placed it on repairing the world. In a letter to Israeli President Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, the Rebbe wrote, quote, "From the time I was a child attending cheder, even before, the vision of the future redemption began to take form in my imagination. The redemption of the Jewish people from their final exile, a redemption of such magnitude and grandeur through which the purpose of the suffering of the harsh decrees and annihilation of exile will be understood." Can you imagine from the time he was in cheder? When other children are thinking about candy and licorice, playing with minions and cars and trucks, when others are imagining running around on the ball field, the Rebbe says from a young age, "I was trying to make sense of the suffering of the centuries and millennia of exile, longing for Mashiach, wanting to bring his arrival." You see in that a few things. I think you see his sensitive soul. What youngster is so sensitive, not only to the persecution that they see, but can connect with the persecution of Jewish history, and also at the same time couple it with a faith that it can and it will be better. 1980, the Rebbe adopted the phrase, "We want Mashiach now," to promote a sense of urgency and longing for Judaism's time of future promised bliss. There was great controversy. The fact that the Rebbe placed so much emphasis on Mashiach caused a lot of controversy. It wasn't simple at all. The Rav commented on it in 1942. Lubavitcher Rebbe speaks and publicizes the Mashiach, and a tumult has erupted, an uproar and an outcry. 1942, remember, is before he's the Rebbe. Becomes the Rebbe in 1950. But the Rav talked about an emphasis on Mashiach. Or maybe I have the date wrong. But what's wrong, I asked, said the Rav? That people who are heretics decry him, I understand. Those who violate Shabbos decry him, I understand. Those who study Talmud and Chassidus decry him, it's inconceivable. Are we not allowed to talk about the belief in the Mashiach anymore? Are we not allowed to long for Mashiach? Why did it become controversial? The Rebbe introduced a campaign for an annual seum of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah to divide the Rambam's Mishneh Torah and to learn enough each day that every year you could learn the totality of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah's Code of Jewish Law. The first year after the campaign, they published a scholarly journal to celebrate this movement. And among those who had essays in the first edition of this journal were of Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, Rav Menashe Akotin Klein, Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung. Sorry for the misspellings. But you see, implicit in the cooperation, participation, contributions of these Gedolei Yisrael to the Rebbe's campaign was their condoning, was their support that it's a good idea. But not everybody thought it was a good idea. Should I give you one guess who didn't think it was a good idea? Page 6. Among Rav Shach's letters, and here it seems he's nitpicking, but among his criticisms of the Rebbe is the fact that the Rebbe instituted this campaign for Rambam. On the left-hand column, page 6. Kasher akasa yaduah chazel sa darko ladaber gdolos bataalumos lasos barash chag ve'ilula b'yom asiri b'shvat. When this kat hayaduah, this fringe group make a big tumult, a big party in the tent of Shvat, when they conclude learning the Rambam, after the takana, after this great campaign to learn the Rambam, asher be'emes kilkalta meruba al takanasa. You've done more harm than good. Now, what harm could you do by learning the Rambam every day? Limsa sect. Limsor la anashim shutam she'inam b'nei Torah limud Rambam shudas yachid. V'yavo yidei zeh lifsok la'atzman kemo da'ato shel Rambam. You have to understand the irony here. Who did Rav Shach dedicate his life to learning? On what work is Rav Shach's magnum opus, the Avi Ezri, written on? The Rambam. And yet, because the Rebbe endorsed the campaign to learn the Rambam, Rav Shach says, what are you doing with the Rambam? He's a Das Yachid. He's a singular opinion. We don't follow him. Einanu lanu ala hatura, Beis Yosef, Shulchan Aruch, Ramah, Shach, Taz, Gedolei Aposkim, Amekubalim, Merabosein Midor Dor, V'gam Manhigam L'chadish Dover, Minhagim L'chadish Dover, Shlo Ola, Daitam Shagone, V'tzadiki Ador, Kemo Achav Itzchayim, Shavadai Liba, Mayacham Yoser. You think, Rebbe, you're more devout, you're more enthusiastic and passionate than the Chafetz Chaim? He didn't institute learning the Rambam. Who are you? And an overemphasis on the Rambam will distort the transmission of halacha. Upala yosem izelalima Torah. Uki'ilu shilufanenu lo yadu mea Rambam. You act as if no one knew who the Rambam was until the Rebbe introduced the campaign to learn the Rambam. The chibru yachad. You made a big party, a big to-do, as if this is a celebration for Klal Yisrael. In Lubavitch, these dates have become as significant as Chanukah and Purim. Udamos as Masha Tiknu Lanu Anshe Knesset Hagdol LeMasha Bada Ish B'Yameinu. On and on and on. Rav Shach is not impressed with the campaign to learn and conclude the Rambam. And again, Rav Shach is mocking the tumult, the party, the celebration they made, but it doesn't acknowledge that among those celebrating, by having contributed essays to the volume to celebrate the first Siyum, the completion, are Rav Moshe and Rav Yaakov and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Rav Zalman Nechemya and so on. Suspicion began to arise that the Rebbe was in fact not just longing for, pining for, but actually may think he was Mashiach. And this is really what set off Rav Shach. Rav Shach's greatest opposition to the Rebbe was what he perceived as a sense of false messianism. And this controversy continues until today. We actually studied it on Shavuos a few years ago. We're not going to revisit it. The messianism, the messianistic movement, what percentage is it of Chabad? Are they a fringe group? Are they more than that? And so on. Rav Shach was the most outspoken and vocal critic of the Rebbe. He opposed the Rebbe's campaigns. The same way we just read about the Rebbe's campaign for the Rambam. We don't have time, but we could read Rav Shach's letters. It's hard to imagine you could oppose these campaigns. He opposed the Shabbos candle campaign, the Tefillin campaign, children parades on Lag BaOmer campaign, and trying to promote and teach the Noahide laws. All the Rebbe's campaigns, which were so met with such great success, Rav Shach was opposed to them all and wrote letters with as much vitriol and rhetoric as the one we just read. When some of the Rebbe's followers outright declared him to be Mashiach, that was it. That was it. When the Yechi movement was born, when there were messianists that arose within Chabad, which created its own controversy, that was the end of the line for Rav Shach. Rav Shach called for a total and utter boycott of Chabad. Chabad Shechita would be no good. Chabad's Gerim would not be good. Chabad's Gittin would not be accepted. Utter and total boycott, a Cherim of the entire Chabad movement. He called the Rebbe a false messiah, compared him to Shabtai Tzvi. He called Chabad a cult. He once sarcastically called Chabad a religion, the religion closest to Judaism. He described the Rebbe as the madman who sits in New York and drives the whole world crazy. You see some of Rav Shach's letters. Page 8. Or actually, page 7. Top right of page 7. Sichos Chabad, Hayom Yesh Dvarim Sh'osh L'Somam. He says, I got your letter in yeshiva. They want to learn some of the Sfarim of Chabad. And he says, Uveprat HaSichos Chabad, Hayom Yesh Behem Ma Sh'osh L'Somam. Kama Divrei Kfira Yesh Behem. Alken Chova LaHasir Alzeh, Avalas Alzeh B'Chochma. He's against learning Chabad Sfarim. And you see, he talks a lot about the Rebbe thinking he's Mashiach. Page 8 is Rav Shach's letter where he says, I have nothing against Hasidim. This isn't Hasidim, this is exclusively against Chabad. Top left on page 8. Eini chafet shiyanira kilu yesh chiluki deos b'misnagdim l'chasidim. This is not an age-old, this is not a continuation of the age-old rivalry of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. No, this is personal. This has to do with Chabad, it has to do with the Rebbe. Page 9, bottom left. Abo shel Mashiach emes ein tzorich lefarsei modos. This is a letter about the Rebbe, that when Mashiach really comes, you're not going to have to take out ads in the newspaper and hang pashkavilias on the wall. You're not going to have to take out billboards. When Mashiach comes, we'll know. Tuna rabosai, shelo titu lisbor sheyesh kvar Mashiach, v'asher kam adam echad, v'hichriz loma sheyesh kvar Mashiach. Don't think Mashiach has arrived, because there's one person who's announced he's here. Duna kizeu Mashiach sheker. It's a false messiah. Uveim aisa yedenu tkifa yitzricham la'acharim b'dvarim shekaila. If we could, we have to put in cheirim and silence such things. You could read the next two pages. He's talking about the Rebbe thinking he's Mashiach. Now, Rav Shach was not the only one who had this concern. If you look at page 11 in the handout, we all know Dr. David Berger today continues to fight the fight. Dr. Berger is the author of a book which depicts the messianism as being the bulk of Chabad, and he takes on Chabad, and really Dr. Berger is frustrated, disappointed in the rest of the Orthodox world. I think the book is called The Story of Orthodox Indifference. It has to do with the Orthodox indifference to this messianic movement. a Jews for Jesus, which is arisen in our day, that he tries to bring a lot of evidence to support. This is from an article he had in Tablet magazine. Did the Rebbe identify himself as Mashiach? And what do his Hasidim believe today? In Joseph Telushkin's book on the Rebbe, on page 11, the bottom, he talks about the fact that there was a movement in the Rebbe's lifetime. There were Chabad Hasidim who tried to announce that he was Mashiach, but that the Rebbe silenced that call. When they would sing the song at a Fabrengen, the Rebbe would make them stop. The Rebbe objected to it. Page 12, this long handout for you to read afterwards, there's fascinating sources in here. Page 12, page 13, it's the whole story of this question. Did the Rebbe believe he was Mashiach? Did he encourage his followers to believe he was Mashiach? Did he allow them to? Did he discourage them to? Skip to page 14. Telushkin's book is fantastic, but even greater, I really enjoyed this book. Rav Chaim Miller has a book called Turning Judaism Outward. It's a biography, but it's an intellectual biography. Telushkin is a hagiography. Telushkin's book is, you fall in love with the Rebbe, you cry, you're inspired, you're moved, but it's not academic, it's not intellectual. This book is phenomenal. It covers every period of the Rebbe's life from when he's born, footnotes and footnotes and footnotes, really well detailed. It's excellent. And here he writes, page 14. When some of his followers began to sing a song in his presence identifying as Mashiach, in 1984, the Rebbe interrupted, and he said, I'd like to speak about something negative that requires fixing. There's some overzealous Chabadniks, Spitz Chabad, who imagine they're the ones who know what needs to be done and how it should be done. They're unmoved when those around them sometimes attempt to dissuade them. They think to themselves, who are these people that tell me not what to do? Not one of them is Spitz Chabad. What I am referring to is those who, as a result of their statements, verbal and print in their songs, have alienated many Jews from the teachings of the Baal Shem, the study and approach of Hasidus. There are Jews who had begun to study Hasidus, and as a result of these individuals' activities, they stopped doing so. Not only are they failing to bring Jews closer, they're alienating those who have already begun to come close. Let it therefore be known that anyone who continues with such activities fights a war against Chabad Hasidus, against the Rebbe Rayatz, his father-in-law, against the Baal Shem, against Mashiach himself, who wants to come, but is waiting for the further dissemination of Hasidus. These people, on the other hand, are distancing Jews from the studying Hasidus. God forbid. Fabrengen later in 1991, scenario from 84 repeated. Some of the participants chanted the same song, imitating him, intimating him as Mashiach. He reacted critically. It's absurd you sing this song with these words while I sit here by the table. The truth is I should have walked out. In written communication from the period, the Rebbe was even more reprimanding. To the editors of Kfar Chabad magazine, who proposed to publish an article speculating the identity of Mashiach, 1991, the Rebbe wrote, if you will, God forbid, do anything resembling this, it'd be better to close down the magazine completely. To another author in 1992, I've already responded to the articles such as these alienate many people, and so on. His position was consistent with the 1968 letter, and so on. Now, the skeptics will tell you that the Rebbe there never denies that he's Mashiach. He just says it's not the time to talk about it. It's alienating people. It's counterproductive. If one reads it genuinely, it seems the Rebbe is protesting that he did not believe he was Mashiach. He did not emerge as Mashiach. Most compelling that he did not is the Kol Kore. On the bottom of page 15. Recently, a number of individuals have made pronouncements regarding the position of Chabad on the issue of Mashiach. The following statement is issued by the governing board of the Central Rabbinic Organization of Chabad, Lubavitch, and it contains all the signatories of the prominent distinguished leaders. And basically says the Rebbe is not Mashiach. It's 1998. So, I share these sources only to show you, within Chabad itself there was controversy. There were those who were messianists who were undermining the Rebbe's own wishes. The greatest evidence leads to the fact that the Rebbe did not see himself as Mashiach and squashed the effort to declare that he was Mashiach. And that those who believe he was or is are a fringe group and do not represent the mainstream. Full page air was taken out in the New York Times to that effect to say that the official position of the leadership of Chabad is that the Rebbe was not Mashiach. Could he be Mashiach? We talked about Shavuos a few years ago. But he wasn't. And it's absurd for anyone to think he is Mashiach. A truck doesn't kill four soldiers and injure 15 others if Mashiach is here. Mashiach is here. Many of the things that are happening don't happen. So all you have to do is look around and you know Mashiach has not arrived. The Rebbe knew that as well. But Rav Shach was skeptical. He thought the Rebbe was fanning these flames, was encouraging this attitude. And therefore, that drew the greatest ire of Rav Shach, who called him a false messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, it's a cult, he's a madman. The Rebbe usually refrained from responding to Rav Shach's attacks. He chose to ignore them, but there were exceptions. This is from a sicha from Tavshin Mem. What is that, 37 years ago? Page 16 is from a sicha. You see where I underline page 16? Rabbi Levine could help us with the Yiddish here, but the one line I understood is the Svarga Apashida Apostle of Tefillin. The Rebbe does not name Rav Shach by name, but in the Sicha, he's talking about somebody whose views are so distorted and backwards that Tefillin are supposed to make a person think straight. It must be that the person with the crazy views who's inciting divisiveness, this Tefillin must be Apostle. You like how I put a picture of Rav Shach in his film? Okay. Anyway. Yes.
I was there at the time. Rebbe spoke of the wrong in the name Rav, didn't name him.
Right.
Whose mind is not Shalakalaleh.
Right.
But for some man is wearing costume.
There it is, page 16. Direct testimony from Moshe Leib, who was there. So that was one of the times that the Rebbe responded, though he responded Baramiza. He didn't use his name, and he did. It's not nearly as harsh. It's not nearly as vitriolic. But he did to throw a zinger back to Rav Shach, then Mustama, his tefillin or puzzle. Rabbinic trash talk. Israeli politics. 1990. It was rumored that the Rebbe intervened in Israeli politics to thwart Shimon Peres' attempt to form a new government. Peres had the number to form a new government. Shamir, 1990, Shamir had lost a vote of no confidence and they needed to form a new government. Peres was assigned he would be able to take over as prime minister if he could put together a new government, and Peres was convinced that he had in fact done so. How did he do so? Because he joined Agudas Yisrael. You know, politics makes strange bedfellows. So to create his coalition, some things have never changed, to create his coalition, he joined with Agudas Yisrael. April 15th, 1990, the new Knesset was to be sworn in, this new coalition. Peres would have been the prime minister. Only one problem. Two members of Agudas Yisrael, who had to show up to be sworn in to create the coalition, were a no-show. Who were they? Eliezer Mizrahi and Avram Verdiger. Both happened to be followers of Chabad. They didn't attend. Peres' coalition disintegrated. Shamir succeeded in reforming the government. Peres was shut down. Anyone remember the name of this event? Anyone remember the name? It's called the Stinky Maneuver. Excellent. It sounds better in the Hebrew. It was, I forgot what they called it in the Hebrew. The Stinky Maneuver. It was known all over Israel as this maneuver. The media immediately reported that these two individuals who were the no-show, who denied Peres the premiership and retained Shamir, were followers of the Rebbe. And that the Rebbe is the one who would influence politics. The New York Times reported, politics in Israel, quote, has again focused attention on the role of a charismatic Brooklyn rabbi who asserts an unusual amount of influence in Israel. Yediot Achronot lamented Israel's fate was, quote, in the hands of a rabbi who lives in Brooklyn who has never set foot in Israel. The Rebbe and his emissaries adamantly denied involvement in the affair, and the Rebbe did not get involved, except he did in one way. What was that? See, Peres had planned on forming the new government with the Haredi party that was controlled by Rav Shach, who was known to be in favor of land for peace deal. What do Peres and Rav Shach have in common? Why can they sit in the same coalition? They both believed in land for peace. When the coalition fell apart, Peres and, by extension, Rav Shach were denied. At the height of the affair, March 26, 1990, there was a rally in the Yad Eliyahu Stadium in Tel Aviv. And the rally, it was a Haredi rally, was broadcast on live national Israeli television. Some of you may remember this incident. Because Rav Shach took the microphone. And he decided, in the context of that rally, and with great frustration at Peres, and Peres as he viewed the leader, the symbol of the secular Israeli society, with great frustration, disappointment, unrealized ambition, Rav Shach took the microphone and unleashed a scathing attack on secular Israelis. Anyone remember the famous line that he had? What did he refer to? He said, quote, "Today one can meet children who don't know what Shabbos is. There are kibbutzim that don't know what Yom Kippur is." This is the line. "No idea. They raise rabbits and pigs there. And this is called the Jewish people." He accused secular Israelis of raising and eating rabbits and pigs. He denounced the secular as Aver Miduldal, a distended limb. Do they have any links with their forefathers? This scathing attack sent shockwaves across Israel media. Rav Shach had taken on the majority of Israel, secular Israelis, who interpreted his attack as saying that in fact, they're not even Jews. These secular kibbutzim, they're raising rabbits and pigs. They don't know what Yom Kippur is. They have no connection to our Avos. They're not even Jews anymore. While the Rebbe had ignored the personal attacks, this speech of Rav Shach, the Rebbe couldn't take it. Why couldn't the Rebbe take it? It speaks of his greatness. Challenged everything he believed in. The Rebbe believed in the inherent holiness of every Jew, in the goodness, in the spark inside every Jew. And the Rebbe responded. The next Shabbos, he delivered a sermon that quoted extensive sources in the concept of inclusivity, and he called on Rav Shach, not by name, to repent for his error. Quote, "Verbal expressions such as these, which dishonor the Jewish people, especially in public, in the presence of countless Jews and non-Jews, requires correction and repentance." The Rebbe in that sermon said that Rav Shach has to do tshuva. Now, we'll get to that in 1 second. Rav Shach's followers will tell you, if you look on page 17, what I have here, pages 17 through 21, is from the notes of the meetings that the Rebbe had, where he's clearly talking about Rav Shach. Rav Shach challenged the Chabad Minag. How could you not sit, how could you not sleep in the sukkah? And the Rebbe's talking about him. He says, "Ein lecha chutzpah gedola mizu, klapei admor zakein lavo kayom lachar mea shana." And he goes on and he talks about, it's very interesting to read this, pages 17, 18. He says, you know, historically, it's very interesting. He says, even the Mesnagdim were not against Hasidus. Rav Chaim Volozhiner spoke to the Baal Tanya. He has all of this tradition, the Rebbe, about their talking and learning, their respect for one another, their acceptance of one another. And he says, this individual, this chutzpan, who challenges our halachic traditions, who thinks that 100 years after all of our unity, he can undermine it with divisiveness and machlokas. And he calls Rav Shach on page 20, "Hein einam b'nei Torah, hein mechutzofim, shelochamim neged Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu, shegormim machlokas v'sinas chinam b'Yisrael, l'achar mea shana shel shalom v'achdus." After 100 years of peace and brotherhood and unity, they have brought strife and divisiveness. And who is this the result of? He says, you know, in the before Mashiach comes, in Ikvas of the Mashicha, Sha'az Miskaberas Chutzpasam Shal Eila Shemamalam Ashlichuso Shel, what's Samach Mem? The Samach Mem is essentially the Satan. It's the evil, wicked force. Lubavitch Rebbe has basically said that Rav Shach is the representation of the Samach Mem. He's bringing this divisiveness, this machlokas, and trying to disrupt the unity that we have achieved. Now, the followers of Rav Shach will tell you that his speech in Yad Eliyahu was very effective. Look at page 22. I found this article by Bezalel Khan. I think it comes from the Yated, maybe. 15 years have gone by since Rabbeinu HaGadol Rav Shach gave his famous speech at Yad Eliyahu. It was on the eve of Shimon Peres' attempt to set up a new government. After the Shamir government was toppled, Rav Shach cried out with a voice tinged with pain to thousands of listeners in the stadium, tens of thousands around the country via live broadcast. "Today we find children," we just read. Next paragraph. "The speech set off a great storm. Broadcast during peak hours, almost every household in Israel heard. At the home of the Kish family, at Kibbutz Ein Charod Yichud, Yair and Shai Kish listened intently, and our Rav Shach's words struck a chord deep inside. Two brothers secretly began to keep mitzvahs, laying tefillin, reciting brachas. Their father, Rabbi Yonasan Binyamin, followed suit. I would do Netilas Yadayim before meals, and few of the kibbutz members, recounts Rabbi Yonasan Kish, whose story has been published in many places. Soon his two sons found themselves in the halls of Torah. Today Rav Shai Yisrael lives in Rechasim, Rav Yara lives in Yerushalayim's Neve Tzi neighborhood. Their father lives in Bayit Vegan. During the day he works as a volunteer for Yad Sarah. The afternoon and evening hours he attends Shiurei Torah. So some had the tradition that Rav Shach's words were effective, and those on the kibbutzim listening decided that in fact they needed to get in touch with their Jewish roots. But the Rebbe had a very different reaction. And the Rebbe, here is the story about the kibbutz, the Rebbe had a different reaction. Page 23. This is from the Sicha the Rebbe gave the Shabbos after Rav Shach's speech in Yad Eliyahu. And here is where he defends the honor of the Jewish people. And he says, Hitpatot hepach kvodan shei Yisrael uveprat befarhesia b'mam mirabim Yisrael pirsum gametzel einam Yehudim doreshes tikun u'tshuva. This speech requires repair. Mi lanu gadol Yeshaya Hanavi kasher hispatei hepach kvodan shei Yisrael av shevada yisasiba mutztekes lekach nena shal yidei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even Yeshaya Hanavi, even though what he said is accurate, but to degrade the Jewish people publicly, he was punished by God. Am Yisrael nimshal sefer Torah. The Jewish people are likened to a Torah scroll. Every Jew is inherently holy. And so on and so on and so on. And he talks about the honor, the dignity of the Jew, and strongly objects to Rav Shach degrading the secular Israelis on the kibbutzim. A few months later, the Rebbe responded uncharacteristically to another attack of Rav Shach. December 1990, the Israeli media was outraged because Rav Shach declared the Holocaust, quote, was definitely a punishment. The Holy One, blessed be He, kept score for hundreds of years until it added up to 6 million. Rav Shach was convinced that God brought the punishment on Jews for violating Shabbos and eating pork, and he suggested, quote, because of the sins, the Almighty may bring another Holocaust upon us, and it may already be tomorrow. Rav Shach definitively declared that the Holocaust was a punishment, and why it was brought upon us, and that Hashem is saving up again, and who knows when He will unleash another Holocaust. Page 24 is an essay, Yesh Din v'Yesh Dayan, that is a quote of Rav Shach's speech, where he outlines this philosophy of the Holocaust. He writes, "Lefnei Mechamas Amifrat, Amar Maran Hagon, Rav Elazar Man Shach, Sicha Nora, Sheisira Bizmano Es Kol Ha'Ulam." Rav Shach gave a wondrous presentation and an impact in his time in the whole world. And what did he say? Zel Shono, underneath the line, Ein Eni Yodeim Advarim Sheyomru Kan Yuarevim La'Oznei Hashomim. I don't know whether the things I say will be sweet, accepted by those who will listen. Allah Shema Emes Lamita, but they're true. The Kolachat she is born with Dvarim Yiras Emes Kemoshi Lomshem Tarovos. And then he went on to talk about the Shoah and to say that it was a punishment from God. This touched a nerve in the Rebbe. If the thought that the Rebbe and Messianism touched a nerve in Rav Shach, then the speech in Yad Eliyahu denigrating secular Jews, and now the speech about the Holocaust touched a nerve in the Rebbe. Why did it touch a nerve in the Rebbe? Because the Rebbe never talked about the Holocaust. The Rebbe never publicly developed a philosophy of theodicy. Why do bad things happen to good people? What was the basis of the Holocaust? He believed Judaism should be driven and motivated by positive sentiments. Talk about God loving us. Talk about faith. Talk about Shabbos. Light candles and bring more light into the world. Talk about redemption. Why are you going to talk about the Holocaust? No one ever became frum because they went to a class about the Holocaust. However, following Rav Shach's words, the Rebbe gave a sermon that most thoroughly spelled out his feelings on the subject. He noted that Rav Shach's analysis was an ineffective method of bringing Jews closer to Judaism. And moreover, it's, quote, untrue, disrespectful to God, and disrespectful to the Jewish people. And here you have it on page 25 from that wonderful book from Rav Chaim Miller, Turning Judaism Outward. Let's read what the Rebbe said together on the bottom. Those who were not observant in this generation of the legal status of children taken into captivity, victims of circumstance, not culpable for their transgression. And then he added, at the bottom of page 25, what kind of person would consider himself qualified to calculate in his own mind of flesh and blood the account of sins? Then he allows it to pass his lips, because in our times there are many Jews who are not currently observant. Terrible consequences are impending. Such an approach is in complete contradiction to what is documented in the Torah, that such Jews are like children taken into captivity, are not culpable. A conception of God is one who sits counting sins, waiting to exact punishment, who refuses to move until he's settled his debts, and then straightaway begins again counting and punishing, is extremely disrespectful to the Almighty. To compare God to a merciless dictator who waits expectantly to punish is a complete misrepresentation, since in truth God is the merciful Father. The Rebbe argued, Scripture depicts your children to God, Banim Atem Makom Lashem, in places even as Bnei Bechori Yisrael. God has an intense love for us. Bottom of 26. Our generation lives in the wake of the Holocaust, which witnessed the murder of 6 million. May God save us from those who pass judgment and the few of us that remain, and say that the present conduct of such Jews will cause another Holocaust. God forbid, may it never occur. Such words are a blatant insult to those who gave up their lives. According to Jewish theology, there are certain negative occurrences which did not come as a punishment for sin, but simply because God decrees so, without any rationale that's fathomable according to the logic of Torah. He goes on and he references Rabbi Akiva. The massacre of 6 million, next page, with such horrific brutality, such an awesome Holocaust that has no comparison throughout history, could not conceivably be punishment for sins. Even Sutton himself, the Satan, could not concoct an account of sins from the last generation that could justify such a heinous punishment. And Miller suggests that Rav Shach's comments, the Rebbe's response, have to be viewed in the context of the time. The end of 90 was a few weeks before the beginning of the Gulf War, when Israel faced a possible attack of chemical weapons. The idea of a second Holocaust was palpably real, particularly an ominous form of intimidation. And so Rav Shach is using a scare tactic. The Holocaust was a punishment. Saddam is aiming Scud missiles with chemical weapons at us. Another Holocaust is imminent if we don't repair our ways. And the Rebbe takes issue with both. How dare you say the Holocaust was punishment? And how dare you use a scare tactic to say that we are unworthy and a second Holocaust is about to be invited upon us? And then afterwards, how the Rebbe interpreted the fact that 39 Scuds landed in Israel and no one was directly injured due to the Scuds. One person had a heart attack because of the Scuds, but no one was directly hit by a Scud. And the Rebbe says at the bottom of page 28, these were revealed miracles, obvious miracles, not only for Jews, for the nations, seen in all the corners of the earth. In view of the existing international conditions, it seems inevitable that not only would there be a declaration of war, the war would engulf many nations, trigger a new world war, God forbid. But in a most extraordinary turn of events, not only was a world war prevented, the war ended shortly after it had begun. A miracle, so wondrous, an absolute and utter miracle. And so the second major point of contention that the Rebbe actually uncharacteristically responded to Rav Shach was the Holocaust. We're finishing up. This is one speech we have. Rav Shach is talking about the Rebbe. It's a little hard to make out, but it gives you a sense.
Paris, Allah, walking to be a Allah.
What was he saying? He says, we're the Baal Machlokas, he's the Baal Machlokas. We're divisive, he's divisive. He won't join any of our efforts. He won't join our educational system. He won't join the Haredi community in all their different efforts. He's the divisive one. He's a tzaddik. Where did he become a tzaddik? In Paris? He's going on and on, Rav Shach, talking about the Rebbe. A few concluding thoughts on this rivalry. Here you have page 29 until the end. Is an article by Rav Shlomo Lawrence, who was very close with Rav Shach. Rav Shach's battle against false messianism. He tells the story about why Rav Shach was so upset, what he tried to do about it, how he joined different political parties, how he launched different Jewish newspapers. You could read the article on your own. But one point I thought was very fascinating. He talks about the fact that Rav Shach desperately did not want the machlokas. He felt he had to stand up for the truth. No one else was willing to. And therefore he did it, even though he desperately didn't want to. But here's an interesting story. It should be noted that in spite of his pitched battle against Lubavitch, Maran, Rav Shach, nevertheless recited Tehillim when the Rebbe became sick. The time I asked him for an explanation, and he obliged. Quote, my battle is against his erroneous approach, against the movement, not against the people in any personal way. I pray for the Rebbe's recovery and simultaneously pray that he abandon his invalid way. I think it's an insight into Rav Shach, because I don't want this talk to be entirely slanted. It's obvious to you perhaps where my sympathies lie. But I don't want it to be too slanted. Rav Shach, we don't understand. I don't understand much of his attacks. I certainly don't understand the methodology, the language of his attacks. Rav Shach was an outstanding Talmud Chacham. Rav Shach was an extraordinary person and leader. And I think from this story you see that for Rav Shach, it wasn't personal. He davened for the Rebbe's recovery and he said he loved the Rebbe. It was what he perceived as false, erroneous, dangerous beliefs of the Rebbe. So in closing, what's Rav Shach's legacy? He's an enormous Talmud Chacham. Rav Chaim Kanievsky describes he would go to Rav Shach's apartment once every 30 days to recite the bracha you say on an outstanding scholar, if you haven't seen for 30 days. He led hundreds of thousands in Israel around the world. He was the posek, the Rosh Yeshiva of Haredi Jewry. His students describe him as humble. Even in his 90s, Rav Shach insisted on carrying his own svarim. He lived a very meager life, very simple life, a non-materialistic life. He had many virtues that we would find admirable outside of reading the letters. I think it's telling his own son's love and affection for his father. Dr. Ephraim Shach tells a story. After his mother passed away, he was in his father's apartment. And one morning, breakfast, he sees his father is eating burnt toast. He has a piece of burnt toast and a Rambam in his hand. And his son says to his father, Abba, can I get you something to go with your toast? Some jam? Some butter? And he says his father looked up at him with all sincerity and said, what do you mean? I have something that goes with my toast. I have the Rambam. The flavor for Rav Shach was not jam or butter. The flavor on his toast was the Rambam. That was Rav Shach. There are things to admire about Rav Shach. His stature, when he passed away, Ariel Sharon was the prime minister at the time, and Ariel Sharon gave quotes about Rav Shach's contribution to the Jewish people, his leadership. It's important to understand and not to, based on this one rivalry, dismiss or somehow be disrespectful of the totality of a person. What's the Rebbe's legacy? This is an interesting quote from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal. The Rebbe's legacy. This point, he's talking about the messianism, which stirred harsh criticism in certain circles to the point of a battle to crush the phenomenon as it involves the Rebbe. Chabad movement, every element and aspect, has definitely cast a shadow over the way many people think of both the man and his movement. This truly was a serious problem. However, in my opinion, this development, terrible as it may be, must not be allowed to overshadow our veneration in retrospect of the man and his movement and make us forget their tremendous achievements, the lofty status they attained. This is a hesped that Rav Aaron gave for the Rebbe. And he says, though there's controversy today with Messianism, we can't allow that controversy to erase the greatness of the Rebbe. And listen to this insight, such a Rav Aaron insight. I want to begin with from precisely this problematic point. It never occurred to anyone to declare that Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Kotler, or the Rav was Mashiach. Did they not have followers? Did they not have a tradition? Were they not part of a dynasty? They certainly did. It seems to me that at the root of the matter, the concept of messianism attached itself to the Rebbe. Because of his image and status, their positive aspects. The Rebbe embodied in a powerful way a certain combination in which one who wished to could see the reflection of a reflection of the King Mashiach. In other words, the whole controversy around the Rebbe is only because we could imagine that he was Mashiach. He's taken over the world. He built an army. He led campaigns. It's a fascinating attitude of the legacy of the Rebbe from Avaron, that whatever your belief on the controversial messianism point, the very fact that there's a debate about the messianism is only because we could imagine the Rebbe as Mashiach. Nobody ever imagined, nobody ever suggested these other individuals were. What is their real legacy? It's a picture from my office. I have a collection, thanks to my friend Yaakov Lyons, of Kisvei Yad, of actual handwritten letters. An individual in our community collects hundreds of them. Incredible. Going back to the Chassam Sofer, Bekiva Eger, and he lent me a bunch to keep me company in my office. Wonderful pictures of these great rabbis and letters on their stationery written from them. I have Rav Shimon Shkop, the Rav, Rav Avadya, Rav Shlomo Zalman. But who do I have next to each other in my office? I have the Rebbe and a dollar bill that the Rebbe gave, that someone gave to me, and Rav Shach. The real legacy, at least posthumously in my office, is for them to be side by side, the growth of Torah, the future of the Jewish people, to heal with a sense of unity and achdus. Thank you very much.